ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, I'm Sana Qadar, and I host All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. If you've ever wondered why people behave the way they do, or what it's like to live inside their heads, this is the show for you. We dive deep each week into a topic related to mental health or psychology, from the promise and perils of manifesting, to how to get better sleep, to what it's like to experience psychosis. Hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Hello, I'm Kate Evans, and welcome to ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf, and a conversation from the recent Canberra Writers' Festival. There's a large and rambunctious audience, so let's join them.
Guys, call it. That's the best welcome. Thank you so much. Hello, and we're so excited to be here for this conversation about our favourite books and writerly influences here at the National Library of Australia for the Canberra Writers' Festival on ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf. I'm Cassie McCullough.
And I'm Kate Evans. Delighted to be here on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, the traditional storytellers of this place. Although I confess I do most of my reading on Gadigal land.
And we're here today with three writers, all of whom have new books just released. And they're going to tell us about those new books, about their own reading favourites. And we'll do our best to find some connections between these three writers as well.
There's a woman who creates a new identity in Tasmania in one of these books, a man who finds stories in letterboxes in Brisbane, and a South Australian chasing stolen hay bales. Now, it seems unlikely, but I'm sure we can draw these fictional characters together somehow, Cassie.
Well, we'll give it a red hot go. So let's meet our panellists. Heather Rose is a novelist, memoirist whose books include The Museum of Modern Love, Bruni, The Butterfly Man, and Nothing Bad Ever Happens Here. Her latest and 10th book is the novel A Great Act of Love. Heather, welcome.
Trent Dalton is a journalist and writer whose novels include Boy Swallows Universe, Lola in the Mirror, and his latest, Gravity Let Me Go. And we should also mention that that debut novel, Boy Swallows Universe, was voted number one in our ABC Radio National Top 100 Books of the 21st Century Countdown. Hi, Trent.
Yeah, congratulations, Trent. Amazing. Also with us, Gary Disher, crime writer and historian, as well as an author of books for children and young adults. His crime fiction includes the Wyatt novels, the Peninsula series, and his latest, Mischance Creek, is part of the Hirsch series. We've lost count. We think there's something like 60 books altogether, Gary. Welcome to you too.
Now, before we get to your own favourite and most influential books, let's hear more about these latest novels of yours. I mean, Heather Rose, A Great Act of Love, it's your first work of historical fiction. Whose story is it and why were you driven to tell it?
So the main character is a young woman called Caroline who has escaped London after a horrific crime has been conducted by her father. And she comes to colonial Van Diemen's Land in the 1830s to reinvent herself and to create something different for the future. It was inspired by two stories. One is that a famous vineyard existed in the 1820s in early colonial Tasmania, and apparently it made a sparkling wine that was so extraordinary it won an award in Paris at the wine show in the late 1820s. Now, this is a myth that has persisted in Tasmanian winemaking a very long time, and there's some really interesting data about it. But when I started going through the research, I realised that my grandmother's great-grandmother, whose name was Caroline, had basically lived next door to this vineyard when she emigrated to colonial Van Diemen's Land as a young widow, because apparently her husband had fallen over Niagara Falls on their honeymoon.
Oh, Niagara Falls, you say?
Wow.
Niagara Falls. I did go back to the archives at Niagara Falls and looked into it, but they don't keep records before 1850 of people who went over either willingly or unwillingly. So,
I see. Well, a great act of love is your book. Trent, I think many people here are completists of your three novels. This fourth, Gravity Let Me Go, Brisbane journalist, don't know where you got that idea from. His name's Noah Cork, but he's also writing true crime and is really haunted by what he uncovers. Introduce us to Noah.
Yeah, journalist, father of two teenage daughters, lives in middle-class Brisbane, moved from outskirts of Brisbane to middle-class Brisbane, wrote a book, and then his life turned to hell. But yeah, he's a true crime journo who is so obsessed with what becomes the true crime scoop of his lifetime. A killer has left a trail of breadcrumbs in his letterbox that leads to a true crime bestseller, essentially. And he's so obsessed by this true crime scoop of his lifetime, he's in danger of missing an even bigger scoop. And that relates to the one that's unfolding in his very own home. It's a story about my own personal storytelling addiction and how the ways in which it kind of gets in the way and gets me in trouble, gets in the way of doing the thing that I should be doing, which is being a great dad and an even better husband. And I wanted to talk about all my failings as a 46-year-old writer who just gets obsessed with these stories in his head. That's everything that Noah Cork's about. And he goes one day to his bathroom and he sees four words written on his bathroom mirror. And the words say, "Gravity, let me go." And if he can work out what that means, he might just hold on to his marriage and hold on to everything that's important in his life.
Wow.
Gary Disher, we've met your character, Paul Hirschhausen, on the page before, even though this book, Mischance Creek, I think it can certainly be read as a standalone. So he's a cop in South Australia. Things are tough. Things are really grim in the area where he's working in small towns. What's life like for your character and what does he make of these small towns?
The backstory of Hirsch is that he was a young detective in Adelaide and it turned out the CIB squad was corrupt. It got disbanded. Some of the mud stuck to him, even though he wasn't corrupt. He'd only been there a few months. He's sent to one officer police station about 3 hours north of Adelaide, halfway between, say, Adelaide and the Flinders Ranges, to dry country. So in most crime fiction, I think the main character is firmly rooted to place. If we take Inspector Wexford in Oxford or Bosch in Los Angeles, but he's a newcomer, so that's a useful level of suspense for me and tension, the fact that he's has to work out how does this place tick, how can I fit in. Another thing is in crime fiction is usually the main investigator, if it's a cop novel, is senior in some way with a squad working under them, but he's just a lonely, lowly constable in a little town in a very dry part of South Australia. He's first on the scene, of course, if there's a suspicious death, there's a local cop. He joins the tennis club, he tries to fit in, and one aspect of his life is to be kind of a social welfare worker, checking up on two teenage children, for example, in the town who are looking after their bipolar mother, or an elderly widow on a back road who's got a schizophrenic son, or investigating the theft of hay bales. That's the mundane day-to-day life for him. But two things crop up in this latest book that we follow through. One is that there's an argy-bargy between two parents at the primary school, and it turns out one of them's a sovereign citizen. Now, the book was written, edited, printed in the warehouse long before Desi Freeman murdered those cops in Victoria recently. But I've been following some of those post-COVID nuts, like the far-right anti-vaxxers and sovereign citizens, thinking that there's violence here. So it proved to be. So that's one of the themes of the novel. The other is he's called to a lonely back road because a motorist has run her four-wheel drive into a ditch, and he pulls her out and they get talking. He thinks she's just a tourist of the outback, and it turns out that she's looking for her missing mother. Her parents had gone gold fossicking several years earlier. Her father found at the bottom of a mine shaft, her mother's body never found. The police treated it as just another outback tragedy at the time, but she was convinced that there's more to it than that, and so is Hirsch once he starts looking at some of the old paperwork.
Mm. Wow, okay, Mischance Creek. Gee, Gary, you've just given me an insight that it's so obvious now that you've said it, but crime really is linked to the granular detail of place, no matter where in the world.
A place,
yes. And it's inherent in the story. So when we read books, crime books from around the world, we're also having a bit of a travelogue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and in fact, you've set up themes that oddly connect these three books, because all of your books explore place and place that connects to where you are. Even though, Gary, you're the only one who's writing in the crime genre, all three books actually explore crime. I mean, there's some terrible crimes that connects directly to your family history, Heather, in your novel. How does crime fit in with this latest book of yours?
The novel begins with a crime on the Battersea Bridge in London, and that was a crime against the murder of a woman who... It was an infamous crime, and the murderer really was my ancestor, and that was a story I never expected to write about. And his sister also has very unusual skills. They, in the book, have both emerged from the French Revolution after the beheading of their parents. They were from French nobility, and so they're émigrés to Britain, and they've both had to make their way in the world in a way that they never anticipated. Jacques Louis, the father who commits the terrible crime, is actually a beloved apothecary and chemist, and has a fall from a roof. In the actual records from the Old Bailey, he's noted several times as having a very serious frontal lobe, what we'd call a frontal lobe injury. He had a massive scar across his forehead from the fall, and the love of his daughters nevertheless persisted, which gave me an interesting insight into what sort of person is so beloved by his family after doing such a horrific thing. And his sister in the book, Henriette, as she is known, becomes a companion to wealthy people, but of course this was the life that she was destined for. She was destined to be a duchess, or perhaps a princess, possibly even a queen, and she thinks that it's most unfair that the French Revolution has caused her to live in, to some extent, penury. She becomes a companion to very wealthy women and then decides to start a career that will replace the wealth and well-being that she believes that she's entitled to.
And so, Trent, the crime element with your book, I mean, is that your character is a true crime writer. I mean, why true crime? Why did you want to hang it on that?
Oh, it reflects my love of the genre. I was a feature writer when I was a full-time journalist, and I would do celebrity profiles, I'd do sporting profiles. The ones I always wanted to do were the crime profiles. They're the most interesting. So if you read Gravity, you get to a scene where we go down under a house. Well, that's inspired directly by the time I interviewed Ivan Milat's brother, Alex, and he took me down to his basement. Oh, you're the best. What a crowd. This is a... Yeah, he took me down to his basement in the Sunshine Coast, and he proceeded to say, further, go to the end of the basement. And he showed me a bullet-making machine. He was a licensed. He's passed now.
I was just thinking, my goodness, is
sorry.
They're very much
nothing.
Good news, defamation.
I'm say, fascinating details, though. Like, the guy had one photograph above his television, and it was a framed photograph of Ivan, which I found bizarre. But yeah, he took me to the end of this basement, and I remember just going, "What am I doing down here?" But also, I remember thinking, "This is going to read so well on Saturday morning." In the Saturday magazine, you know, and you ask your fella about the lengths journos will go for a story, and it's kind of disturbing. Like, that always, like, it's fascinating. We will do a lot. We will do. I remember I wanted to get an interview with the Rebels motorcycle gang head. he was in prison and he was getting out, and I had to go with his lawyer. And I went out on this boat in the middle of the Brisbane River. I'm going, what am I doing here? Like, and it was all copy. It's just anything you do for copy. And that's a strange compulsion that I'm very familiar with. And that's why Noah Cork in Gravity has these weird compulsions. And it's like, how far will you go, mate? Will you actually even risk your family? And I would never do that. But I know there's parts of me that have have sometimes that my wife thinks, like my wife would find out about what I've done in the paper. And she'd go, why were you doing that? And I'm like, sorry, honey, sorry. And that's what Gravity's about, yeah.
Trent Dalton on his latest novel, Gravity Let Me Go, on stage at the recent Canberra Writers' Festival, alongside writers Heather Rose and Gary Disher. I'm Kate Evans. This is ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf. Back to the stage now and my co-host, Cassie McCullough.
Now, Gary and Trent, actually, you've given your character, you've both given your characters books to read in your recent novels. Noah Trent is reading Geraldine Brooks in Gravity Let Me Go, and Gary Hirsch is wrestling with a whole pile of books from an op shop. What was that, a little sort of writerly flourish from you both? Or you go first, Gary.
Yeah. I had an amusing time to myself writing that, but also what gave me even greater pleasure was one of the books, it says on the blurb, written in the outback tradition of Jane Harper.
So. And when did you start writing, Gary?
As a child.
So you might have predated Jane just a bit.
Although I did notice, Gary, that Hirsch was listening to Radio National in the car.
I was
very pleased about that. I mean,
I want to get a tick from everyone I can think of.
But we promised that we'd ask you all about favourite books, maybe books that have influenced you. I mean, where would you start, Heather, in thinking about a book that is at the top of your list?
It's such a difficult question for a writer. I started collecting books once I got my first house, which was actually in Melbourne after I'd been travelling for a few years, having left Tasmania as a teenager to go overseas and see the world, because I thought that's what writers had to do. And I read a book called A Canticle for Leibowitz when I was only about 17, and it's about an extraordinary library that is the only way that the history of humanity is preserved over thousands of years. And I thought, I'm going to do that for my children and my grandchildren. So I find that I remember the books that were influential by what age I was. So I vividly recall reading Still Life with Woodpecker by Tom Robbins when I was 16 and going, I didn't know people did that. And, you know, Rebecca when I was about 14 or 15 and thinking, oh, things get complex with characters. And I hadn't seen the kind of complexity that she brings to that in some of the previous works that I'd read. And that was probably one of my early works of historical fiction. And, of course, I had a wonderful teacher in grade 3 who read us The Hobbit, and that got me onto reading The Lord of the Rings in grade 4. But my dad gave me Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea when I was only 6, because he couldn't slow me down, he said, because I was, you know, all the golden books were just being chewed through. And it was beautiful to read that story, but also haunting for me because I'd never read a story with an unhappy ending before. So they were very pivotal. But as I got older, Anna Karenina is something I read every 10 years deliberately to see who I am in response to it. At the Age of Innocence, Edith Wharton, the Murakamis, the David Mitchells. I tend to read all the works of every writer that I love just to understand their process and to see how they've developed as a writer and what themes have interested them, and Kazuo Ishiguro is also a great favourite of mine.
We did ask everyone to submit some books, and Heather submitted her own top 100.
That's the best. I love that. Look how many. And can I get that list?
But promise to whittle it down, so, you know, you can have this.
I did write Kate an email and apologised afterwards, and I said, I'm sorry.
You never have to apologise to us for talking about books and being passionate about them. So, Trent, what are you absolutely passionate about as a reader?
Well, here's the thing I'm most passionate about. I believe this thing that it's one of the many wonders of books. Here's one that doesn't get spoken about much. That you can read a book that was passed down to you from someone you love who you have lost, and you can read a passage, and if you're crying, invariably they cried too, and you are with them again. So Cassie so kindly mentioned Geraldine Brooks. One thing that connects us three writers, we worked out outside, was we all had these beautiful dads that in part made us the writers we are. Is that fair to say? Yeah. My dad, man, like he bought every St. Vinny's paperback you could find in Brackenridge, Brighton, Housing Commission, Brisbane. And he just handed them all to us. And but the last book he handed to me before he died of too many durries in 2016 was Year of Wonders by Geraldine. And so in Gravity, I pay tribute to her because Noah Cork suffers this, not suffers, he is deeply affected by this wild storm that happens in Brisbane around 2008 or something, which is when Geraldine released People of the Book, which I totally adored. But the last book, so that's why I mentioned her in there, and that's just me fanboying and just about my total literary crush. But there is a really deep thing between Year of Wonders and myself and my dad. It's this fascinating thing we can do, and you can do it with like David Bowie. You can do it with John Lennon. You know, you can, it's such a connecting thing. So you can read these books that these greats loved, like Hemingway. Hemingway wrote all the books that he loved, and you can go, oh, wow, he must have felt that too. And it's this really powerful thing, yeah. So, and Geraldine is also, for me, this great blueprint for any wannabe journo who wants to kind of try their hand. Like, she did it masterfully, like, and she did it with such ambition with Year of Wonders, but it's so journalistic. And it's like my favorite journalism feature articles always start small and you go big by word 3,000, right? That's in a 4,000 word magazine article. But she starts so small in her novel. It's a plague story, 1666, a village in like Derbyshire, and it starts with a plague-infected cloth. That's where she begins. And it comes into this village, and it's everything that happens from there, including love and all the worst parts of humanity. And the whole big lesson is it's not these external forces that affect us humans. Sometimes the worst of us is coming from the inside. And it's like such a brilliant thing that I reckon she learned as a foreign correspondent. You know, like you learn that when you do journalism. And so it's so deep to me. That's just a starting point of one that I sort of suggested to you first off because, yeah, it's so meaningful. But it's because of Dad. It's because of Dad why that particular Geraldine Brooks book means so much. Yeah.
That's a beautiful connection to have to your father.
Yeah.
And that book, I think, has something magical about it. It was in my top 10 in our countdown. That beginning, as you say, is extraordinary. And it's the smell and the sound of apples tumbling into a cellar to prepare for winter. And it's amazing. She's extraordinary.
This is the thing about the wonder of it, right? I mean, it's everything I write about in my books. I try and say, yeah, it's dark, man. It's dark out there, but let's see if we can remember the light as well. And that's what Geraldine remembered as well in that book. Yeah.
Gary Disher, the stakes are high here. You're going to have to give us a book that evokes the passion, the feeling, your personal history as we add to this shared bookshelf.
Well, I think we can blame it on my father a lot of this. Three things. He said to me, farming's a mug's game, get an education. He said to me, Well, he was a great reader, so there were always books in the house. And he didn't read to us at bedtime. He told his own story. So I think that was a pretty powerful influence on me. I suppose my interest in crime writing or thrillers or suspense tension novels stems from Enid Blyton and the Biggles books, because they were simple stories about... They were crime stories in the sense it might be gang of kids outwitting smugglers or whatever it might be. So I was reading them when I was very young and deciding to be a writer then. But there was no such thing as young adult fiction when I grew up. So at around about the age of 10, 11, 12, I started reading my father's adult novels, some of the World War II ones, for example, the Russell Braddon's The Naked Island, I think it was called, The Cruel Sea by Nicholas Montserrat, The Ship That Died of Shame by Nicholas Montserrat. So I was growing up on those books. But I must admit, I did encounter my first book banning at around about the age of 11 when my father gently removed from my hands a James Bond book and said, I don't think it's quite, you're quite ready for this yet. So,
and that was just the quality of the writing, right?
Possibly. Yeah. And after that, I think what's influenced me most is reading the short stories of William Trevor and Alice Munro, and a little bit later, the stories of Raymond Carver and Richard Ford. I think I've got a very pared-back writing style. And early in my career, I had about, say, 50 short stories published in literary magazines, like the late lamented Mianjin and Overland and Westerly and so on. And I think the pared-back writing style, the importance of suggestion, the importance of every word counting comes from that. Reading those short stories.
I'm so glad you've brought up short stories because one of my favourite books of all time was a collection of short stories from 1989. You were in it. It was. Does anyone remember a book called Expressway, which was edited by Helen Daniel? Yeah, you remember? And it had on the cover the Jeffrey Smart picture, Carl Expressway, the fat man with a missing arm, which ironically was also on the cover of Peter Carey's Fat Man in History at around the same time, so slightly confusing. This wonderful late Helen Daniel sent to about 35 writers the postcard of the image and asked them to respond with a short story, and incredibly, 29 writers did. And so all these responses went together in a book, just sort of clashing up against each other or finding these themes, and yours was one. What's fascinating about that collection is that Helen Daniel, managed to pick so many writers who went on to have enormous careers. So for me, it's been a gift that keeps giving because I was introduced to writers like yourself very early on. So yeah, there's a great place for short stories, but also short story anthologies, as well as collections by a single author. I love them.
And that is a message for any publishers in the audience. We think it's a great idea and that it could happen again. And we should say too that here at the Canberra Writers Festival and on ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf, I'm Kate Evans, here as always with Cassie McCullough and with
writers. Not always here though, Kate.
No, but we're always
sometimes
together.
Sometimes we're at Radio National.
And not, sometimes but, yeah. we're arguing, but you know, who could possibly say? But I will add that we're here with the writers Trent Dalton, Gary Disher and Heather Rose, and what we're wanting to do is find out about their reading, their influences, the things that they love, the things they return to, or sometimes there's books that you love so much that you can never reread it in case the experience isn't the same. Now, Heather, you said that you return to Anna Karenina every 10 years. Are there other books that are touchstones for you?
Orlando, Virginia Woolf's Orlando, I read a lot. I listen to it a lot. All my most favourite novels I also have as audiobooks. So I have editions because I'm a bit of a, you know, if I find an edition in the secondhand bookstore and I haven't got that edition of a loved book, I'll buy it. It's a very dangerous pursuit, I have to say. It takes a lot of space. But I love Orlando because it's such an unusual way of telling time and exquisite characterization, and Virginia Woolf has such a craft in her work. So I love the strangeness of that. And interestingly that you mentioned Peter Carey's Fat Man in History, because when I was 16, I was doing English literature and my teacher put that into my hands. And I had a pretty much a steady diet of gum trees in Australian writing through Patrick White and Nan Chauncey, and it was the first time I realised that you could be an Australian writer and not write about gum trees and the outback, and in fact you could write different genres because that book is full of different genres. Yeah,
it's a seriously weird book.
Yeah, it made me...
Right.
I think it really fostered a love of attempting different genres in me that has seemed to follow on from that. Annie Illiwacker is hilarious.
Oh, Illiwacker.
So great, yeah, it's such a brilliant novel. There's quite a number I go back to. I do love the non-fictions as well. I'm madly in love at the moment with Robert McFarlane's new book, Is a River Alive? And I urge you all to read it. He reads it himself as an audiobook, but it's an exquisite hardback too. That one is told with all the gravitas that he brings to his work now that he's done such an extraordinary deep dive into our humanity through looking into landscape, and be that underland, overland, all over the place. And now he's looked into rivers and their fundamental, essential nature to our nature, and that the health of river reflects the health of human beings, which is, it's beautifully, beautifully told.
Mm. Well, he's an extraordinary writer indeed. Mm. What about you, Trent? I mean, another book that you love.
Yep.
For what reason? Tell us another one.
Oh, this other one I wanted to really talk about because I owe it a lot. Steve Toltz's A Fraction of the Whole. I read that book just kind of prior to writing Boy Swallows Universe. I came at a time where I read it and I was writing for the Weekend Oz Mag. I remember reading it. It's all about this three generations of a family called the Dean family. And this Dean family just reminded me of the Dalton family. And essentially they're really pretty quirky, interesting people who find themselves in a life of Australian crime. And I remember reading it thinking, it's so well written and brilliant and funny and just wild and unexpected, and there are twists in it that are just unbelievable. But there's a guy in there named Martin Dean. He's this roguish uncle of the guy who's telling the story, and he's so rogue-like that he reminded me of the guy, this heroin dealer who raised me and my brothers when we were kids in Brisbane in the 1980s. And I was like, it's almost like what Heather said. It's like, oh, I didn't realize I can write about that stuff. And I could even, because he was writing about, Steve sort of seemed to know that world. And I was like, I could almost write like that and set it in Brisbane. And that's how I could sort of through a window like that, with that style of joy and bounce and vibrancy to the writing, I could almost get through the horrendous stuff that's in my head. You know what I mean? If I had that kind of level of distance and kind of humor about it, then I could really go to the violence my mum endured. You know what I mean? Like, Steve Toltz helped me do that. And I was just like, I owe him a lot and I owe that book a lot. And it was right around then where Catherine Milne, the editor from HarperCollins, flew up. She read an article I'd written in the Weekend Oz Mag, and she flew up to Brisbane. I was thinking about all this stuff, reading Steve Toltz, all these things were going through my head. And she came up to this cafe in Brisbane and she says, I think you might have a book in you. And I had Steve Toltz in my head, and I had this wild Fraction of the Whole story. I was like, oh, well, when I was a kid, my brothers and I found this secret room that belonged to our stepdad, and he was a drug dealer, and he went away for 10 years to Bogger Road Prison. And we found a red telephone in his underneath his house in this brick room. And we always wondered who the heck was on the other end of the telephone. Would you let me write a book where we find out who's on the end of the telephone? And she's like, write it, write it. And it's kind of all because of Steve Toltz, you know? It's like, it's just, so thank you, Steve, if you're listening, and thank you, Fraction of a Whole, because, yeah, that was Steve just going, you can have a story where a guy kills the Australian cricket captain, you know, and people might read it, you know? It's just, it was a wild story like that, and I was like, it was so ambitious and so impossible that you go, well, anything's possible.
Well, audacious books that show you that anything's possible, or shock you with what they can do, or give you reading inspiration because they go somewhere that you hadn't seen on the page before. Heather, Gary, are there books like that for you?
I think I first struck it when I read an American novel by Evan Connell called Mrs. Bridge. He tells the story of Mrs. Bridge in fragments. Some of them might only be a paragraph long. It'll be some little incident from her day. For example, one of the little incidents is called Dirty Towels, how she keeps changing the guest towels in the spare bathroom because they must always be clean. In fact, she would rather they were never used. And it gave me a sense that you can tell a story like that. So my novel, The Sunken Road, which unfortunately sank without trace in Australia, it was nominated for the Booker Prize, but it's
very good.
I loved it.
Oh, thank you.
It's a really beautiful novel.
I tell the life story of a woman in a farming district, from childhood to old age, in fragments. So that a fragment might be 6 or 7 pages long, with a title like Water, Dust, Dirt, Christmas, Easter. And around that little theme, I'll tell her story from childhood to old age, over and over again. But gradually some of the secrets of her life come to the surface as we read the book. I've never written anything else like it. Like most of the books you read probably and the films you see are linear in structure, but this, a fragmentary book, which grew out of that American novel.
Gary, 2 weeks ago, Cassie and I were sitting on stage with a writer, an American writer called Eric Puchner, and he told us about that book, Mrs. Bridge. And it was the first time I'd heard about it. And he was similarly inspired by that fragmentary nature.
Yeah, and he's a professor of creative writing at Johns Hopkins, so, you know, you might be onto something there, Gary.
I also found books that incorporated the incorporeal, like Beloved by Toni Morrison, such an exquisite evocation of being haunted by the past. And Murakami does it all the time. You know, in every single one of his books, there's a sort of hauntedness to the narrative. People are living slightly apart from whatever we deem reality, that amorphous term reality. It's also there, I mean, it's obviously there in David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas too, in a strange way, the haunting over generations and indeed over lifetimes.
And playing around with time.
And playing around with time is always so interesting. I love it when books play around with time.
Just while we're talking about, you know, books that we are, well, that's what we're doing. We're talking about books we love, favourite books here at the Canberra Writers Festival. This is The Bookshelf. And with us, Gary Disher, Heather Rose, and Trent. But Heather, you said that Middlemarch was one of the books you love. I've wanted to read it. I actually just read it in the last year or two to find out what everybody is on about. It is extraordinary.
I'll give it a plug.
Go on.
Written by George Eliot, who wrote as George Eliot so that people wouldn't know that she was a woman. And it's an exquisite portrait of a young woman who marries a man who she believes will give her a great deal of intellectual freedom, but in fact he is nothing but jealous and vindictive to her. And she eventually finds the man of her dreams. But the craft of the writing is exquisite, and it has the most beautiful finishing passage that I've pretty much read in any book. Always makes me cry. It is one of those books that you realise women's lives through time have been complicated and difficult, and in order to have any creative outlet, it's cost women a great deal, be that in painting or literature, in any form of art, and the price has often been our relationships with men.
Mm, beautifully put. It's a very long book and you've done it great justice.
Gary Disher, is there something that you return to, or are there books that just sit there on your shelf and you think, I can never reread that?
There's a bit of both. The books I return to in recent years, certainly the crime novels of John Sanford and Michael Connelly and Ian Rankin, I reread them with pleasure each time. Of the books that are not crime, I think I've read Colin Toyban's Brooklyn a few times in recent years, stories of Alice Munro. Ron Rash is a favourite author of mine. I think he's a wonderful short story writer. I don't know why he's not on your top 100 list. Cormac McCarthy's Child of God in particular I return to quite often.
Tell us more about that one. Why does that one...
Well, it's shorter than the others. actually, I should say that for me, the most exquisite, perfect form is the short novel. Mm. Not necessarily the novella, but the short novel. So quite often I return to them because they're an extension of the short story, which I value greatly.
I'm not sure that I can ever return to Cormac McCarthy's The Road, though.
No, even though I think
it's wonderful, but I'm not sure I can put myself through it again.
Yeah. I could never lift the cellar door again. You don't get over that, I don't think. But I go back to Sutri. You don't love Sutri as much?
I've read it twice, I think.
Yeah.
And Helen Garner's The Children's Bark, I like. Yeah. Mm. They're ones I've reread in recent years. I used to love Kingsley Amis. In particular, I'd read every year Lucky Jim. And then about, say, 10 years ago, I read it again and I thought, God, this is a badly dated book. It was no longer funny.
It's a shocking moment, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Novelist Gary Disher on the books we can't return to as we talk favourite and influential books here on ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf. But surely we can squeeze in a few more titles.
Trent, would you like to recommend one more book or tell us about one that's been a lot?
I just need to tell you all about the book that changed my life the most is Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck. I mean, yeah, there's people like clapping and stuff, yeah. No, I'm feeling you because I remember reading that. I was 20. I was starting out as a journo and I was living in a half a house with this British World War II veteran. And his name was Tom. And he was a drunk and we shared like the hall, like it was this, you know, $50 a week rent type place. It was like, and off one side of the hall was my bit of the house and off the other side was Tom's bit. And he had this ginger cat that every night he would scream things like, "Jerry's coming, get down!" and like stuff like this. And I remember reading Grapes of Wrath with this guy who could easily just slip into like Cannery Row. He could have been straight out of Cannery Row, this guy. And he reminded me of my old man, Tommy, and he reminded me of so many people that I sort of grew up with. And there I'm reading about this family making their way to California. And it was just so powerful in the way that guy, it was almost journalistic in its detail, which I loved, but there's these last two pages. Like, and if you're asking me what I reread, I sit that book down by my side when I write anything. I have like Leaves of Grass by Walt Whitman. I've got this amazing hardback that I found. It's unbelievable. And I've got like Silence of the Lambs because these are all influences in my books. It's like make them as thrilling as that and make them as moving as, and make it as moving as Steinbeck and make it as kind of existential as Walt Whitman, you know, or as thoughtful, hopefully. That's what I'm trying to do. I never ever get there, but you know, you're trying, and maybe one day I hope to. But the last two pages of Grapes of Wrath, there is an act of generosity, of human generosity, that literally made me want to be a social affairs writer, like made me want to do stories about people who fall through the cracks. And it's from the least likely character, Rosa Charon. She does this act of generosity to a complete stranger to save that person's life. And it just honestly changed my life. Like, you know, like can two pages of a book change your life? It's like, I tell people, like, you want to feel something about this world or you want to find some hope? Just like read Grapes of Wrath and get to those final two pages and see what type of human you might want to be, you know? And it's like how good we can be, you know? And it's just the goodness of this family and the sort of straight up nature of how they get by as a family. Like it's everything that I believe about family, you know? It's like I'm from a family that got by just through love, you know? Like I'm absolutely from a family that just hung together just through the ethics of love, you know? And it's like, that's what Steinbeck's writing about. Yeah, that's the one that I really stays with me in a big way.
And that's what reading does to us, or can do to us.
Hell yeah.
Look, I've told Kate this story before, but John Steinbeck's The Breakfast is one of my favourite short stories of all time. And my older son was doing it for school and he didn't want to do it. I said, look, you do the dishes and I'll read it to you. And I started to read it and by the end of the second page, I just was gulping.
Really? Yeah.
Weeping.
Yeah.
Because it was full of exactly what you've described. It's it's coming out of darkness into a dawn and there's a homeless person walking along a country road and there's these three people eating bacon and coffee. They got coffee and they say, hey, come and sit down with us. And it's about the end of the bust, you know, like it's about the end of the great, you know, poverty.
Yeah.
And the generosity returns and you know.
I love that. I love when writers start, it's like Cold Mountain. Remember Cold Mountain?
Yeah. Right.
And he's just talking about the meat that the guy, he's carrying around that old bit of meat and he carves into it and he's so hungry. Just, I love when writers talk about the value of food if you don't have any, you know, those great writers who can detail that
Yes.
Stuff like that, and you can feel it, you know.
That's Charles Frazier's Cold Mountain.
Charles Frazier, yeah, yeah. Brilliant writer, yeah.
Yeah, and that's one that I often reread, but it's got alternating characters, and sometimes I'll read Inman, and sometimes I'll read Ruby.
Oh, what a cool thing to do.
Depending on the sort of mood that I'm in. Look, we'd love you to start thinking about the books that you would like to add to this shared pile, something that has, not something you feel mediocre about, something that you respond to as passionately as these writers respond to. Of course, you could ask a question as well, but we'd love it if you would include in it something about those reading moments,
what like
they
a
are.
Sort of meeting where you say your name and...
Yeah, you stand up. I'm Kate and I read every day.
Well, that's a great place to start, Kate. I think you're on the beginning of a long journey.
But so put your hand up if you would like to do that. And, you know, Cassie and I have this thing every single week when we talk about books, and we call it reviewer regret or reader regret, and it's the thing that you wished you'd said and that you didn't say. And so for you three, this is the chance to throw in that book that you're going to walk out the door and go, but I didn't talk about, you know, my absolute favourite. So
I have to go The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle by Haruki Murakami and Light in August by William Faulkner. I think the two most perfect forms of the novel I've ever read. You know, writing a novel is a craft of form as much as it is about character and landscape and dialogue and all those things. But those two novels have this magnificent arc in them in terms of form, and I go back to them often to look at how on earth they did it. But you made me think of Mice and Men as well, Trent. You know, talk about the short novel. Oh, my goodness, and heartbreaking. So heartbreaking.
Can you pass on that advice about short novels while you're talking to other writers at the festival? You'd be doing me a great favour, Gary.
Well, on the topic of short novels, I think Claire Keegan's novels are exquisite. I admire them greatly, and they are ones I'll be rereading.
And if you haven't read the Irish writer Claire Keegan, you can literally read everything that she's published in one weekend, and I would highly recommend it. Now, we have a reader up the back.
Hi. Thanks. Hi, I'm Emma. I love hearing all of your insights, so thank you so much. I just encountered for the first time by Stephen King, The Life of Chuck. And the way it's disconnected from a linear, typical linear structure, and at the beginning you think it's going to be one thing and then it turns out to be something quite different. And it's really stayed with me, and I love how it's playful, and I also love the length of it, so the short length of it. So, yeah, thank you. Very interesting.
Brilliant, Emma. Thank you for
that. Thank you. And there's another reader here. And there are plenty of readers here who are being a bit shy. There's someone down the front.
Hello, I'm Carmel. And talking about a differing style, I'll never forget being on the train in Sydney on the way into Sydney University. You know, so I'm 16, 17, reading the opening page of James Joyce's Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man. And it just blew my mind because I'd never come across anything like it. It was confronting but incredibly seductive. So, and can I quickly get in one of my passions, again, I think because I was a teenager when I started it, but the historical works of Dorothy Dunnett's The Lyman Chronicles that nobody has ever heard of.
No, I have to confess I haven't.
Yeah, but that ability to put you into a scene and be there and stay with you. I'm 75 and to still be there in those scenes and appreciate the way in which she was able to just, well, more than describe. So, but Joyce and Salinger.
Wow, I'm loving a conversation, Cassie, that has already taken us from Stephen King through James Joyce and Dorothy Dunnett. And we have another reader here.
Hi, I'm Robert Henderson. Look, I just want to say that, like Mr. Disher, I've really enjoyed Richard Stark's Parker series and Donald E. Westlake's alternative to that, the Dortmunder series, which is humorous as opposed to Parker's criminal. And like you've written Wyatt, much like Parker, have you thought of ever doing a comic twist like that? And I just have to say that your novels have often moved me very deeply, often about characters who've unfortunately died or been killed or have had loss and so on. So thank you.
That's beautifully put. Thank you.
Thank you. Would you like to respond, Gary?
Yeah, sure. I think crime writers in particular work within a tradition. So, yeah, I plainly state this, I base the Wyatt novels on the Parker novels, but I hope in the process that Wyatt's my creation, not a mere copy. In terms of comic crime, I find comic writing very hard to do, and I don't like comic crime fiction. It's a transgression. So, but I'm glad you find the books moving. I think I don't sit down and say to myself I'm writing a crime novel. I'm writing a novel in which there might be crime, because I like writing about people. One of the questions that typically is said to drive crime fiction is whodunit. But I think there are much more interesting questions driving crime fiction. For example, what sort of person did it? Why did they do it? How will they be found out? So I like writing about human nature, what makes people tick.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Kate. I just wanted to thank all of you and to mention a book that I really loved called Mr. Pip by Lloyd Jones. I don't know if people know that book. And the beauty, the thing I love about it is it's set in Bougainville when there's a horrible war going on and a lot of disruption. And from the point of view of a young person in that society, and they end up with one book that the teacher can teach from, and it's Great Expectations. So it's a beautiful tribute to the power of one book to maintain some sense of the way these people can find a joy and beauty and relationship amidst when their society is just falling apart. So that's the book that I'd like to say. And Trent, I think the Boy Swallowed Universe blew my mind.
Oh, so, love you.
Well deserved. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Kate, and thank you for mentioning a New Zealand writer. And I think, shall we have just one more?
Hello there, my name's Mel. Thank you all so much. Trent, I will also say A Year of Wonders by Geraldine Brooks absolutely blew my mind
Great.
It's a recent read for me, so it will stay with me forever.
Right.
But my book, we'll very luckily be hearing from her later on, Hannah Kent's Devotion.
Yeah.
That utterly changed my reading thoughts forever. When something happens two-thirds into the book and you don't think, how can this continue? But her wrapping around environment in the way that she does and nature is just so moving. So, yes, that's my book. So thank you.
Oh, we love getting reading lists and recommendations. It's what we live for.
Yes, and Devotion, a great description of two very different landscapes, beautifully done by Hannah Kent. Well, look, I think we are out of time, but thank you for being such a great audience, and thank you, and why don't we thank our fantastic authors as well.
Can we thank Kate Evans and Cassie McCullough?
Amazing. Icons.
The wonderfully generous writers Heather Rose, Gary Disher and Trent Dalton on stage at the 2025 Canberra Writers Festival. I'm Kate Evans. The Bookshelf will be back next time talking historical crime fiction. So join us again then for more books. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.